Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You give us half an hour, we give you the meltdown. Downgrades, the Dow, and what happens now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation, supporting customer choice and clean, efficient energy sources and technologies, working with customers nationwide to create a sustainable energy future. Constellation.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It's the 8th of August today. Well, you know, we were going to do the numbers music right there, but that's electronics and live radio. But here's the deal. The Dow Industrials plunged 5.5% today, 634 points. The NASDAQ off 6.9%, 174 points. The S&P 500, 6.2%, 79 points. Money looking for a safe haven. What did it do? Oh, yeah, it went to those downgraded U.S. bonds. Prices rose enough to push the yield down on the 10-year T-note to 2.34%. So we don't usually do the numbers up at the top of the show. It's kind of unusual, but suffice it to say, these are unusual times. And we're going to be talking to a guy named David Beers in a couple of minutes. He runs sovereign credit ratings for Standard & Poor's. But before we get there, let's take a step back and retrace how we got to AA+. From New York, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith starts us off.
Standard & Poor's said it had two reasons for downgrading U.S. debt. Call it a cocktail, equal parts economic and political. And that's pretty unusual, says economic analyst Keith Davis with Farr, Miller & Washington.
It's a critique of the whole political process. It's as much a critique of that as it is, you know, our financial situation.
In its statement, S&P said it doesn't think Congress will be able to bridge the political gap and do what needs to be done to reduce the deficit. And a lot more needs to be done, says Michelle Meyer, senior U.S. economist for Bank of America Merrill Lynch.
So in order to have a true plan for fiscal austerity, it has to address Medicare, Medicaid, and also tax reform.
Tax reform, a.k.a. raising taxes and closing tax loopholes to help pay down the deficit. Nearly all Republican lawmakers have signed a pledge not to raise taxes. Charles Gabriel heads Capital Alpha Partners, a political risk forecasting group.
Well, the biggest fights are, you know, clearly over Republicans' resistance to adding any new revenue as part of the solution. On the other hand, the Democrats are very resistant to tackling entitlements.
S&P said the cuts Congress has made are not sufficient. It also blamed an unwillingness to raise revenues and invest in kickstarting the economy and creating jobs, jobs which would generate tax revenue. Again, analyst Keith Davis.
S&P outlined a few things that they needed to see to be more comforted that we are on a more sustainable path going forward with regard to meeting our debt. The political wrangling that took place, I think, signaled to them that we are not up to the task of coming to a compromise.
Particularly with elections just around the corner. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
A reasonable question right about here might be, so if our political system can't run our economy anymore, who can? Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has that part of the story.
Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke only has two tools left in his belt, but he's been using both a lot lately. He's hammered interest rates down to zero and ratcheted up the printing presses several times. And some say it's time to crank them up again and print more money.
The theory is that what we already owe on the debt would become easier to pay back because each dollar would be worth less.
You heard right. George Mason University professor Todd Zawicki says the Fed may be considering a little inflation. That way, the government could repay the expensive dollars it borrowed with cheaper ones. It would help underwater homebuyers, too. Former White House economic advisor Jared Bernstein says there's something to this idea.
And I would be an advocate of going a small part of the way there, but not too far. And by the way, the Fed has followed this route by injecting more credit into our financial system, and it's actually helped quite a bit.
But for Professor Zwicky, any more cheap money from the Fed would be like burning a firebreak to contain a forest fire.
what history teaches us is that once you get a little bit of inflation, you get this upward spiral, and it starts to accelerate after that. The controlled burn may not work, and you may end up with a forest fire.
Runaway inflation would do even more harm to the economy, he says. So despite the Fed's ability to tinker at the edges of the economy's problems, both Zwicky and Bernstein say there's no getting around the tough political decisions on spending and taxes.
Since the Fed is an independent agency, they can engage in monetary policy without Congress and a bunch of Tea Party folks jumping up and down and renting their garments. But fiscal policy, which I believe would be much more effective right now, involves Congress, and that's a very heavy lift.
So heavy that rating agencies and many investors question whether we've got the political muscle to pull it off. Should the Fed want to lend a hand, its interest rate setting committee meets tomorrow. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, you don't really want to know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
I think that it's the S&P trying to cover up for the terrible blunders they made before.
It's going to affect our standing in the world marketplace, and it's going to affect our economy in general.
That was John Rocaz in Chicago, Illinois. Laura Duville in Portland, Oregon, about the meltdown today. If I could apply a little Newtonian physics to the world of high finance here for just a second, specifically Newton's third law, the one that goes for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. The United States of America isn't the only one that finds itself downgraded by Standard & Poor's today. S&P cut the ratings of big insurance companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the mortgage companies, and a whole slew of others because their finances are so closely intertwined with Washington's. David Beers is the global head of sovereign ratings at Standard & Poor's. That is, he was at the center of the downgrade decision this past Friday. Mr. Beers, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Kai. It's good to be with you.
This downgrade from Friday afternoon, was it a comment on the American economy or on American politics?
Well, the rating is not of the U.S. economy. It's the rating we attach to the government. The whole process that we've observed this year around the debt ceiling debate highlights for us a greater degree of uncertainty about policy than is characteristic of AAA sovereigns that we rate.
Are you really worried that America's not going to pay its bills? I mean, isn't that what a credit rating's about?
Yeah, but we have, believe it or not, a large spectrum of credit ratings. So today, the U.S. has the second highest credit rating. Before Friday, it had the highest rating. By any objective standard, the creditworthiness of the United States government, in our estimation, remains very strong. It's just slightly less strong than it was.
No big deal? Is that what you're saying? I mean, you took a long time to say it, but that sort of seems like the takeaway.
Well, I'm describing you the literal meaning of our ratings. I'm not denying that any time a rating, particularly of a government, is cut from AAA, that that's, of some significance to the marketplace. But I'm trying to put it in perspective in terms of the literal meaning of our rating.
What does the United States have to do to get back to the land of AAA?
Given the difficulties in creating a political consensus in Washington around fiscal policy and fiscal policy choices, if we saw in the coming years progress on that, and that was translated into further meaningful action to deal with the rising debt burden of the U.S., then the two in combination could mean that the U.S.'s rating could return to AAA again. But that's going to take time.
There has been, as I'm sure you've seen and heard over the weekend, a lot of pushback against this, pointing out specifically the mistake you guys made in measuring against the wrong baseline, the $2 trillion mistake, to quote the White House.
Others, yeah, and by the way, yeah, we completely reject that characterization of what happened.
All right, but the fact is, you got the numbers wrong as you were going into the White House.
No, that is not the case. We looked at the savings that the CBO estimated, and we ran some projections one way. And the Treasury suggested to us it would be better to run them another way. And so when you run the numbers different ways, you're going to come up with slightly different results. Nobody knows, of course, when you're projecting government budget numbers, which are very large, what the correct number is ultimately going to be.
Fair enough. The other part of the pushback, though, was the ratings agency's role in the financial crisis and AAAs that were perhaps not deserved on some of the bonds that were out there. So the question does arise, Where is the ratings agencies and specifically S&P's credibility on this when there have been such mistakes in the past?
What we're talking about is our government ratings. We're not talking about other ratings. And that's the group that I had. And it's that track record that I and my team are accountable for.
Is it the place of you and your team to judge and pronounce on where and how sovereigns allocate their fiscal and economic policy?
We're not giving policy advice to the U.S. government or anybody else. Governments sometimes have to make trade-offs in their decisions, and we're not saying that the U.S. government should have any particular rating. All we're saying is that on current trends, if the debt burden continues to rise, and if, you know, the political gridlock continues, these things, in our opinion, and under our, you know, published ratings criteria, mean that the rating has come down a notch and could fall again.
David Beers, Global Head of Sovereign Ratings at Standard & Poor's. Mr. Beers, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
I've heard a few different things about what might happen with interest rates. You know, and possibly might hold off on buying a house right now.
2008 was like the bottom, and now it's just like another dip. But you figure if we're in it for the long haul, you might as well have faith.
McGregor Gilronan in Portland, Oregon. Jake Roderick in Chicago, Illinois. Their thoughts on this whole thing today. There is a certain numbness that creeps in when you start seeing downturns on the Dow like we've seen the past couple of sessions. Like it can't possibly be real because it's just so crazy. Except that if the past 3 years have taught us anything, it's that market slides like these can be all too real and all too damaging. So do you sell or do you buy or do you do nothing? For some help with that, we've got Tess Vigeland here. She's the host of our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, it's called. Hey, Tess.
Hello, Guy.
So let's start, I suppose, with interest rates. Theory being the downgrade means interest rates are going to go up because the government's going to have to pay more to service its debts.
Yep.
What about our debts? Is there a trickle down here?
There is, but it's not likely to be something that you notice in a big way unless you have an adjustable rate mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
Your credit card rate may go up ever so slightly because of the downgrade, but it's going to go up a heck of a lot more if you miss a payment. Most auto loans are fixed rate. A lot of folks have 30-year fixed mortgages, so absolutely nothing is going to happen there. But again, if you have an adjustable mortgage, you may see a difference only because we're talking about such a big chunk of money, but it's not going to be a huge jump.
And over time, right? Not like tomorrow.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, talk me down off the stock market ledge. My mind is back in like 2008, 2009.
Uh-oh. You don't want it to be there, Kai.
No, not
a good place to be. Yeah. How about we all take a deep breath?
Yes.
If you are looking at your portfolio today, it's not going to be pretty. If you're looking at it in a month, it's probably not going to be pretty. But here's your other option, Kai. Don't look. Right?
Yeah, I suppose.
I mean, most of what we call average investors, they're in the market through retirement plans, college savings plans. If you're younger, you're probably more in stocks. You don't need that money. And what you're doing is dollar cost averaging.
Same amount invested over time gets you a better deal.
Exactly.
Basically.
If you're older or maybe your kid is heading to college, you probably shouldn't have a lot of exposure to stocks anyway. But if you're feeling crunched, Reuters personal finance editor Lauren Young says it might be time to hire a professional.
There are defensive, conservative type things that you can look at. And what you need might be income just so that you don't have to touch your nest egg. There's all sorts of ways of looking at taking Social Security. And I wish I could say there was a blanket thing that everybody could do one thing and that it would all be okay. But that's not the case.
And, you know, Lauren also pointed out, if you move all your money to cash, you're not getting anything for it right now. You will inevitably also miss out on whatever recovery happens down the line. And, you know, Kai, that's exactly what happened back in March of 2009.
Yeah, it is. But here's the thing, right? I mean, people are looking at today and they're thinking, oh, my goodness, we're in 2008. And it was a long way down to the bottom in March of 2009. What are we supposed to do? Just sit and watch?
That's exactly what you're supposed to do if you are a long-term investor. We are not about what happens every day, every week, even every month or every year. Put that statement away. Don't look at it. If you really feel like you got to do something, review your asset allocation. You want a little more gold? Get some. You want a little more emerging markets? Get some. Just don't do it all at once because you are acting right now on fear, on irrationality. You're not a professional investor. Frankly, a lot of them are not acting rational either. But here's something else you can do. You can educate yourself. I talked to Richard Peterson, who's a psychiatrist and investment advisor with a firm called Market Psych, and here's what he told me earlier today.
I think that, you know, this is a wake-up call, that it's time to pay attention to what is finance? How do companies earn money? all of these things that maybe we didn't really want to pay attention to, it's important for all of us to take some responsibility and be thoughtful about it.
And maybe think about what you can do to protect yourself from some of the broader economic concerns out there. Get rid of debt. Take action on things you can control.
And also, don't open those statement envelopes when they come, because that's just
it.
Scary. Tess Figlin, she hosts our personal financial marketplace, Money. Thanks, Tess.
Thanks, Kai.
If you've got questions about how all of this affects you, your student loan perhaps, or your mortgage, is another recession nigh? Tess and a panel of experts are going to be taking questions on Wednesday. The answers on Marketplace Money this weekend. Details on our website, marketplace.org.
I don't think it'll mean much to me personally. I think my credit rating is still somewhat safe. I think the company should be worried.
What are people who are trying to live whose credit scores are low, if even our country is losing their credibility?
Todd Stevens in Lenox, Massachusetts. Brandy Bronstein in Birmingham, Alabama. Coming up in a little bit, the financial slowpocalypse.
General dismay. It's a further manifestation of the depth and duration of this economic downturn.
But first, let's do the numbers. There they are, those wah-wah trombones. Oh, how I've missed you. The Dow plunged 5.5% today, 634 points, 10,809. The NASDAQ dove 6.9%, 174 points, ended at 2357. The S&P 500 gave away 6.2%, 79 points. When the route ended, it was at 1119. As we mentioned, bond prices rose. The yield fell to 2.34%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com. By Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the internet and stopping unwanted email. Reputation.com. And by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Federal Open Market Committee meets to discuss interest rates. A peace memorial in Nagasaki commemorates the anniversary of the atomic bomb dropped on the city during World War II. And the United Nations celebrates International Day of the World's Indigenous People. This year's focus is protecting traditional arts and crafts. I'm Katherine Roberts.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Much as happened last week, today in the markets wasn't just us. Europe and Asia went along for the trouncing as well. So we made our man in Shanghai, Rob Schmitz, stay up past his bedtime to join me and Stephen Beard from London for a chat about the day in the global marketplace. And Stephen, things in Europe didn't quite start as badly as we'd feared, but they did lose steam by the close, yes?
Yes, I mean, Europe initially was sort of rather preoccupied with its own debt problem, and it drew some encouragement from the fact that the European Central Bank announced it was going to buy government bonds, and it was interpreted this meant Spanish and Italian government bonds, staving off the possibility that Italy and Spain might default anytime soon. So that gave the Europeans some encouragement, but that feeling didn't last.
Well, Rob Schmitz, you are the Asian markets about which we were talking here all weekend. Remind us what happened and then explain why.
Well, the markets didn't go down as much as I think people thought they would. And I think that's primarily because of China. China's the big player in the Asian markets, obviously. And I think everyone knows that it will continue to buy U.S. Treasury bonds, largely because that really remains the only option for it.
Pick up on that for a second, because there's some fear here, Rob, that the Chinese are now going to say, especially after the government came out this weekend and said, hey, you guys better behave yourselves to the United States. There are some worries that China is going to stop buying treasuries or at least diversify its portfolio.
that's definitely an urban myth, and it seems to be going around. China's not about to move away from buying U.S. treasuries, and it's not going to dump them. And here's why. It will remain the biggest foreign holder of U.S. debt. It owns 15% of our debt because it has to. It keeps buying U.S. treasuries because it helps keep China's currency artificially low. And that, in turn, helps keep China's exports really cheap, and that gives stability to China by keeping people employed. So if it dumped U.S. treasuries, China's currency would appreciate, and inflation would just get worse in China. And the government in Beijing knows that historically, out-of-control inflation is oftentimes synonymous with social unrest.
Stephen Beard in London, the last time you and I spoke about the European debt crisis, I asked you, I think somewhat facetiously, but I might have been a little bit serious, if we could be done with European debt crises stories now because there was this deal to be had. Clearly, no.
No, indeed. And the European Central Bank wading into the Spanish and Italian government bond market today certainly doesn't end the crisis, because nobody believes that the bank is going to be able to buy all of Italy's national debt. There's $2.6 trillion worth of it. So the solution is probably not going to occur until we see even more market mayhem, even more blood on the carpet.
Yeah, because that's what we need. Rob, that word that Stephen kept using, solution. I mean, China was the solution last time around, right? It had this huge stimulus package. It kept the Chinese economy growing through the 2008 recession. Any chance that's going to happen again?
Probably not. This is a real concern, obviously. And, you know, China doesn't really have a lot of good options like it did 3 years ago. You know, 3 years ago, it spent $500 billion on a stimulus package, and that helped prevent the global financial crisis from getting worse. But it wasn't spent very well. There's hundreds of billions of dollars in bad loans to local governments for really poorly thought out infrastructure projects that really aren't going to be paid back. You know, one of those now more infamous projects is China's high-speed rail. And that was a project that was rushed ahead with tons of stimulus money. But now look at it. We've already seen a terrible crash that's having both an enormous economic but also sociological impact on the Chinese.
Stephen, we've been hearing through the broadcast today. We went out and got a bunch of sound from regular people on the street, asking them what they're thinking about. If we did the same thing in Europe, what would Europeans be talking about? What are they expecting now?
Well, I think this S&P downgrade on this side of the pond has had a big symbolic importance more than anything else. It's a symbol of what's happening throughout the developed industrial world. Governments and households borrowed too much money during the boom, and they, or I should say we, the US and Europe primarily, now face the painful process of paying off those debts or getting bailed out or going bust.
Rob Schmitz in Shanghai, Stephen Beard in London. Thank you, guys.
Okay, Kai.
Thanks.
I think that it's going to increase inflation.
I'm worried about what this means for me in the future in terms of jobs.
Matt Drobak in Clayton, Missouri. Jeff Nelson out in Scottsdale, Arizona. It seems, as we wrap things up today, like it might be good to take a step back to reinforce the lesson that the markets are not the economy and the economy is not the markets, although they are related. Our New York bureau chief, Heidi Moore, is the voice of reason today. Hey, Heidi.
Hey, Kai.
So the markets have seen, needless to say, better days. What was it about today and the end of last week?
Well, today was a huge symbolic shock to the U.S. It's the first time in history that we've lost our credit rating, and it's a little mortifying. So naturally, people were expecting a bloodbath in the stock markets, and they certainly got it. It was really ugly out there. The Dow was down 631 points. But ironically, just one day in the market doesn't tell us what we need to know about the economy. And what S&P's downgrade was really about was the economy and where we're going. And that is nowhere good. We are clearly not on an upward trajectory. So I talked to some people in the markets about what they were hearing and seeing. And one of them was Charles Horn. He's a banking lawyer with Morrison & Foerster. And he's been talking to his clients who are bankers. And here's what he told me they were saying.
I would say that the reaction I heard from my clients was general dismay. Frankly, they were depressed by it. It's a further manifestation of the depth and duration of this economic downturn, that we are having difficulty getting out of it.
So today looks like an apocalypse in the market, but it's not. A true apocalypse would have been if people sold treasury bonds, if you saw a banking crisis. But we've learned from 2008. We know how we're interrelated now. And what we're going to see instead is a slow apocalypse.
What does it say, then, that the bond market actually was attractive to people today, that people bought U.S. bonds and interest rates actually fell? Help me with that.
I know. Don't you wish that when your credit score gets downgraded that you have to pay less to borrow? But that's the case. I mean, you know, the U.S. is creditworthy. Even S&P says it's creditworthy. The issue is not whether we can pay our bills. The issue during the debt ceiling debate was whether we would. We didn't get a good answer to that, and S&P was very unhappy about it. You know, we're still a very creditworthy country, and we're also the place where people can put their money safely. You know, you can always buy and sell a treasury bond. That will always be possible, and that's what investors know, so they keep buying them.
All right, so the thing is that treasury bonds don't create any jobs. How do we get substantive economic help out of what's going on today and this past week?
Think of it this way. It's kind of like a choose-your-own-adventure book, right? Do you remember those from when you
vaguely,
were a kid?
Yeah.
And so we have chosen the wrong adventure.
Okay.
For the past 20 years, we have chosen the adventure with, you know, taking on too much debt and not really thinking about the future. And now we have to chew through our ropes and confront the thugs and take a look at what you said, jobs. And that's the most important thing. So people have been talking for a long time about creating some sort of works progress administration type effort, you know, infrastructure. We have things that need to be fixed in this country. And if we can somehow be really bold and big and get people to work there, maybe we can move the needle. But we can't cut or tax our way to a good economy. We're going to have to create jobs.
Very quickly, what is your gut right now? Is it fear or just unease?
It's unease, but it's going to be unease for a really long time. We have to get rid of our debt as a country. We have to, you know, fix our budget. We have to get our political system working and our economy back on track. So, you know, it is unease, but we should get used to it. This is, as they say, the new normal.
Heidi Moore, our New York bureau chief. Thanks a lot, Heidi.
Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for freelancers and small businesses designed to help save time, look professional, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today in which Standard & Poor's beats up on Warren Buffett. The billionaire went on CNBC this morning, said he wasn't worried at all about the debt downgrade, and said, in fact, that the downgrade changed his opinion of S&P, not his opinion of U.S. Treasuries. Funnily enough, a couple of hours later, S&P put Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway, on notice for a possible credit rating downgrade. Also, we should note here, Berkshire Hathaway is the single biggest shareholder in S&P's competitor. That'd be Moody's. And that would be the end of this radio show. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media on this crazy, crazy Monday. Today, the Dow lost 634 points, 5.5%. The NASDAQ gave back 174.6 points, 9%. The S&P 500 gave away 79 points, 6.2%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back here.
If I fail to predict your future, I would pay quite substantial fine. I will even go to jail.
The Freakonomics of Predictions. I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.